The more I've talked to people about this, the more I've realized that it's quite common with all of us that we all know what it feels like to try to find our people. And unfortunately, the school cafeteria was one of the most dangerous places to do that. I remember for me, I grew up in a little town on the west part of the state of Alabama. And so when you made that turn with your tray into the cafeteria, the first decision you had to make had been made for you, because based on the color of your skin, it had already been decided where you were supposed to sit. Half the cafeteria was black and half the cafeteria was white. I know a lot of you are going, in Alabama? Then you had to make a decision on who your people were. And we all naturally begin to surround ourselves with people who like us, right? So you tried to find, where are the people that like me? But then we also surround ourselves with people who are like us, right? So maybe for you, it was, you walk past the table that had the jocks at it. Or you walk past the table with the preps. Or maybe the band kids, or the math club, or the drama crew. By the looks of some of you, maybe the stoners, or the goths, or the hipsters. I'm just kidding. Some of you, though, this is crazy. Our culture is so segmented now. There's a group of people that are called bronies. Anybody know what a brony is? Anybody? There's one or two. What's a brony? Down at Southside, Noonan, Peachtree City, you guys got any bronies down there? Any of our strategic partner churches? Bronies are, it's bros, dudes that like My Little Pony. Bronies. And this is a very passionate, proud group of people. For me, I walked past the table that had the Christian kids. And some days, when I was feeling more spiritual or more righteous, when I was feeling accepted, I would sit down at the Christian table. But there were always some real weird things that would be said at that table. Like, everything was a God thing, you know? It was like, oh my goodness, square pizza today, such a God thing. I was just hoping we would. Or, this is no lie, I was sitting across the table from a girl one day at the Christian table, and I asked her out. And she responded and said, the Holy Spirit told me to tell you no. I wish I was kidding you. I was like, listen, I can accept a no from you, but you're telling me the God Almighty, the Lord of creation, the King of Kings is telling me no? Is that what you're saying? That's a little more difficult to accept. But we all know it ends at school, right? It ends when you're in middle school, high school. No, it doesn't end there. See, we're constantly, all of us are trying to find our people. And once we find the boundaries of our tables, it educates us as to who's not our people, who are not in our crew. We begin to segment ourselves politically. And if you affiliate with my party, then you're in. And if not, you're out. We affiliate by sexual orientation or identity. If you see the world the way I see it, you're in. If not, you're out. We do it by race. We do it by religion. In fact, Christians, we really are known as some of the worst at doing this. We are known for creating little subcultures, bubbles, if you will, circles of people, spheres of groups, or just tables that are just for people that are like us, that believe like us, and those are the only ones that are in. And then we begin to demonize everyone that's outside. Any group that's not a part of our group, well, they're just separate. Here's the challenge that we're going to learn today. Some of you know this because some of you do this so well, but this challenges me. As we've been in the middle of this journey from January 1st to April 1st, beginning of the year to Easter Sunday, we're journeying through the life of Jesus. And what we're going to learn about Jesus is that though we surround ourselves with people who like us and who are like us, Jesus, he wasn't like that. Maybe more difficult, Jesus wouldn't like that. This is challenging. It's one of the most difficult things when interacting with Jesus is we want to find what table can we sit at? Who are our people? What is our group? Because it helps us know, well, who is not. But Jesus constantly broke through those kinds of barriers. He was inviting all kinds of people to the table. He was offering a seat to people that we would have said, I don't know that they should have a seat. But let me ask you, is this just a first century thing, or is this also a 21st century thing? Judging by the awkward laughter, I would imagine that we could all agree on that, that though our culture, though our society is becoming more diverse, our society is also becoming simultaneously more divided, segmented, polarized, segregated, balkanized, and homogeneous as well. It's becoming tougher to disagree with someone and still have a relationship with them. Our government is stymied. Our elections are no longer just contests over policies, but they have become bitter choices of different ways of life. I read this recently, that in 1976, if you look at the presidential election in 1976, and this has nothing to do with who was elected or the candidates that were running, but 25%, one out of four Americans, lived in a county where the election results were deemed a landslide. It was an overwhelming majority one way or the other. One out of four Americans, 25%. Fast forward, 2016, 80% of counties won in a landslide. See, we're finding our people, we're clumping together with people that look like us, that talk like us, that agree with our opinions, that believe the same thing, and all of us are guilty of it. It's an all skate. All of us are doing this, and then we just reaffirm what we believe with news sources and people that we're around and opinions that we listen to, and it just further segments our culture. And it wouldn't be a problem, except that it seems like it's a problem to Jesus. He didn't seem to live life like this. No, he seemed to be quite adept at having civil, terrific conversation with people that seemed to complicate things. So today I want to tell you a story. It's really all that I want to do. I just want to introduce you to a story. It's going to be familiar to a lot of you. If you're a person that grew up in church, then this will be familiar to you. And if you're a person that just would identify as a Christian, you would raise your hand and say, yeah, that's who I am. I'm trying to follow Jesus. As uncomfortable as this might make us, I believe this is something that we have to evaluate when it comes to the way Jesus lived. If you're not a Christian, in fact, this might be the thing that drives you most crazy about Christians. The good news is, you're welcome to just stay in your bubble if you have one, or stay at your table if you'd like, or you're also welcome to play along and just think about what would it be like to live life the way Jesus seemed to live life. Here's the way the story begins. We find it in almost the entire chapter of John 4, and the person who's writing to us is John, one of Jesus' closest followers. And here's what he says to begin this. He says, so Jesus left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. So he's giving us some context. You got to understand a little bit about the Middle Eastern world in the first century, a little geography lesson. And he says, now, he had to go through Samaria, which I know a lot of you scholars are going, no, he didn't have to go through Samaria. And you would be right if you said that, because he didn't. In fact, the most common path, the most common route that Jewish people would take when they were going from Judea down to Galilee is they would follow along the Jordan River and they would skirt the side of Samaria, and then they would have to just pass through just the corner. Why? Because they didn't like these people. The most direct route was to go right through it, but you didn't have to go that way. In fact, most people went another way, but Jesus is trying to tell us something even by the route that he took to get to Galilee. One of my favorite titles of who Jesus is given to us by the Apostle Paul. Paul wrote a bunch of letters that we have now in what we call the New Testament. And in one of the letters, he calls Jesus the image of the invisible God. I love that, because sometimes I get frustrated because God seems invisible, feels invisible. And Paul seemed to be going, yeah, I get it. That's frustrating. It's hard to try to follow someone who is invisible. But good news, Jesus is the image of the invisible God. So if you want to know what God's like, just watch him. If you want to know how God feels, just watch Jesus. If you want to know how God would interact with people, just follow along. If you want to know who God likes at his table and who God looks at and says, to quote the amazing movie Forrest Gump, seats taken, can't sit here, which was kind of an Australian accent there, come to think of it, but If you want to know who God said that to, then follow along. Follow the life of Jesus. Because if you look at Jesus long enough, you learn a little bit about what the Father thinks about all of us. So the story continues, John 4, verse 5. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, or Sychar, depending on however you want to say it. You know, you do you. Near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. And he gives us a lot of context. He's letting us know, hey, this was a real place. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well, and it was about noon. Now, why is he telling us that it was about noon? For those of you that have been to that part of the world, you know how hot it would have been at noon. Or for those of you who have ever been to Texas, then you also know what it's like to be standing on the face of the sun in the middle of the summer. It is blazing hot in the Middle East at noon. And somebody would have gone to the well at noon, maybe because they didn't want to face the ridicule. They didn't want to have to figure out which table should I sit at. So they just decided, because of their past, because of what they were embarrassed of, they were just going to go and they were going to eat alone, or get water alone in this case. And Jesus asks this person a question, which is very interesting. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" Now, this Samaritan woman was struck by how awkward this was. See, we don't have all this context, but John is going to help us out. The Samaritan woman said to him, "Well, you are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" And it was as if John knew there's going to come a day where somebody's going to read this and they're not going to know all the history between the Jews and the Samaritans. They're not going to know about all the bad blood, all the turmoil, all the dirty things that have happened in the past. And so he lets us in. He says, "For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." This woman couldn't believe it. Jesus was sitting at his table, and Jesus looks at her and says, "Hey, you're welcome to grab a seat." She's going, I'm sorry, me? Jesus is looking around going, "Well, there's no one else here but us, so yeah, you. Come on, have a seat. In fact, could I have a sip of water?" The levels of social no-nos that he was pushing through, the social norms that Jesus was busting apart, are just stacked like layers in this story. A Jewish man talking to a Samaritan woman? A man wouldn't have spoken to a woman like this in public. A Jewish person wouldn't have spoken to a Samaritan person. But then we're going to find out some things about her that are going to let us know even more cultural reasons why this conversation should have never happened in the first place. But Jesus is a little different than maybe you would think. He certainly was different than what the religious people of the day in the first century were used to. So Jesus answers her. He says, "Hey, well, I'll tell you why I'm talking to you." Jesus said to her, "Well, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." Now, Jesus is clearly, he's changing the context of the conversation. He's not talking about this physical need that he's trying to meet anymore. He's digging deeper, letting her know, hey, there's a kind of appetite that all humans are longing for, and I can meet it. But she doesn't pick up on his language. And so she says, "Well, sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep, so how are you going to get the water out of the well? How are you going to get this water, this living water, out of this well?" And he explains it to her, gives us a little more detail. He answers her and says, "Well, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water that I give will never thirst. Indeed, he explains it another way. He says, indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Over and over again, Jesus has said before, he says after, I didn't come for healthy people. I came for sick people. I'm not trying to give water to people that don't feel like they need water. I'm trying to find the thirsty people that know that they need a Savior, and I'm trying to let them know I am here for you. I'm trying to let them know that they have a seat at my table. You might not be able to find another place that you can sit. Well, the God of the universe is here in flesh to let you know I would like for you to come and sit with me. Come on, you're invited. Just sit down. How should this lady receive this offer? What should she say? Thank you. And she should sit down. But she, maybe like you, maybe she's thinking, this is odd. I don't really know why we're even having this conversation. This person is offering something that only God seems like he could offer. But yet he's offering it to me. He must not know who I am. If he knew all my backstory, he would be offering me a seat on Jerry Springer's show, not at his table. He lets her in, though, on a little secret. He lets her in that he knows about her past, that this isn't a mistake. He says, hey, real quick, would you go call your husband and come back? Hey, just go grab your husband, come back, I'll talk to both of you about this. And she says, oh, yeah, here we go. Sir, I don't actually have a husband. All the single ladies, right? She's like, I'm good. It's just me. I don't have a husband. And he says to her, he says, you are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is that you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true. As our three-year-old would say, busted. Right? Jesus is letting her know, listen, I know who you are. We all know who you are. But you're welcome to come and sit down anyway. Your past is not getting in the way of me extending you an invitation. And your past doesn't have to get in the way of you accepting the invitation. You got a seat at my table. See, this lady was a complete social outcast. This woman had been ostracized. She had been marked as immoral. She was an unmarried woman living openly with the sixth man in a series of relationships that she had. She had the scarlet A put on her, not once, twice, three times, four times, five times. The culture, her community, they had probably kicked her out. How do you think this woman thought God viewed her? See, we try to stack up all of the things that we've done. We try to stack up all of our good. Church attendance. Good person. I've been generous to other people. And it's as if Jesus is saying, hey, that's cool. And like, I'm glad, and you should be. And everybody ought to have an answer for how they're trying to give back in the world. That's fantastic. But I know all of your skeletons. I know all the stuff that happened in college, spring break, Daytona. I know all about it. Some of you are like, why the shade on Daytona? I don't know. Panama City, wherever it was for you. God's going, I know all of that. I know about the broken relationships. I know about the harsh conversation. I know about the habit. I know about the addiction. You can hide it from other people. You're not hiding it from me. However, that doesn't mean that I'm not extending you an invitation. I'm still asking you, would you like to sit down? This lady says, sir, I can tell that you're a prophet. Jesus says, oh, it's more than that. And she responds and says, well, I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. And when he comes, I'm just going to get him to explain everything to us. She's basically trying to get out of this conversation, right? She's like, there's someone coming and he's going to be able to explain this, but I've got to go because it's gotten awkward very quickly. But Jesus, in love and in compassion, lets her know, I, the one speaking to you, am he. We can't even understand how powerful this had to be to this woman. That he's letting her know, I am the King of Kings. I am the God of the universe. Me and the Father are one. God has sent me, the image of the invisible God, to let you know that I know all about your past. And I just want to let you know that you can still be in if you would just accept my invitation. See, this shatters all of our paradigms, shatters all of our ideas of who should be allowed at the table. And this shattered this woman's idea of what she thought about God and what God must have thought about her. How do we know this? Because look at what this woman does next. I love this. Then, leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, she left the thing that she came there for. She walked all that way to get the water, but she was so dumbfounded, so amazed, so awestruck by what Jesus had offered to her that she was like, I don't even need that water. I got the living water now. It's going to be, yeah, well, you're still going to be thirsty. But anyway, it's still going to be awesome. And she went back to her town and told everyone. She said, come, see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? She went back to her town and let everybody know, hey, if he's letting me sit down, then he probably will let you sit down too. Come and see this man who told me everything I ever did. Everybody was like, did he tell you everything? Like, did he fill in the details about that fourth marriage, you know? And she was like, yeah, he told me all of that too. They're like, wow, this is really something. She's like, no, it was amazing. And he offered me the invitation of a lifetime. Here's what I think this causes me to do. Here's what I would love to encourage you to be honest about is I think it makes us have to rethink who's at our table. See, maybe you work with someone from a different culture. Maybe you work with someone who has a different kind of lifestyle. Maybe you work with someone who seems like they wouldn't be part of your group. They wouldn't be part of your circle. They wouldn't be included at your table. I just wonder, is Jesus pushing us to reevaluate who's allowed at our table? See, I think it's worth you and I at least making a choice to be honest about your table. Would you just be honest about it? Would you go through the exercise of determining what informs the boundary of your table? Is it skin color? Is it socioeconomic level? Is it some sort of sexual orientation? Is it some sort of life experience or background? Is it education? Is it what neighborhood they live in? Is it what part of the town they're from? I think it's worth just asking the question, well, who can sit at my table? Here, in case this message is not awkward enough, because it was already a little awkward, and then I was going to show this Heineken commercial where they did this amazing experience, but I know a lot of you don't like Heineken beer, and so that would have turned some people off, and kidding. In fact, I sent it to Andy. I was like, Andy, would you show this? And he's like, hey, your career, not mine, man. So, and I was like, okay, well, I won't show that, but let me ask this question, because this is me, you know, pushing just a little bit since we only have a few minutes left. Who do you not want to sit next to on a plane? You know what I'm talking about? When somebody's walking down the runway on the plane, when they're walking down the thing, and you're like, I hope they just keep on going. Some of you, it's me. Because I sometimes, this week, I'm going to fly with a couple of our little kids, and I know the look. You know, it's like, oh, dear God of heaven, if I've ever prayed, I pray that this middle seat would stay open and that this person with these little kids would just keep walking. For some of you, that's true. But who is it? Who's the person that you're like, I don't really want them to come and sit down next to me? Because those are not my people. I think Jesus is challenging us to at least evaluate. Let me give you another example. There is a book by an author, a Christian guy named Richard Beck. It's a fascinating, fascinating person. Really interesting, important book. And he gives us this illustration. He calls it the moral circle, okay? Let's just say this is you. Well, these are the people around you. And Richard Beck says, let's just imagine, this is your moral circle. These are the people that are included. And unfortunately, they usually look like us, think like us, talk like us, act like us, have the same background as us, share the same worldview as us, and that's who is included in our moral circle. So let me, in an attempt to challenge all of our circles, let me offer you this illustration. Let's say, how many of you have waited tables before? A few of you. Some of you, you know the difficulty, you know the challenge that can be, right? Waiting tables. Others of you know what it's like to give the person waiting tables a hard time. But all of us are in there somewhere. Let's just say this person is a friend of yours. Good friend, brother, cousin, nephew, son, parent. You go to the restaurant because this is their first night working there. And you're like, hey, we're going to go see how this goes. And everything goes wrong. You order steak, brings you fish. You order a Diet Coke, brings you a Pepsi. Sorry, it's an Atlanta joke. You order sweet tea, they bring you unsweet tea, which is the most cruel and unusual punishment that you can ever give anyone. The most unusual sip you'll ever have. Let's just say everything goes wrong. How do you respond? Hey, don't you worry about us. We don't even need drinks. I don't even like water. We don't need water. It's fine. We're fine. Everything's great. You're great. And then how do you tip? You overtip because you love this person. You want to make sure that they're feeling okay and doing okay. Now, let me just flip the scenario. Let's say, same example, it's a person and you have no idea who this person is. You've never met them before. You don't know this person's background. You don't know this person's story. You don't know where this person's coming from. You don't know what this person has overcome. You don't know anything about this person. All you know is the experience is terrible. And so you start doing the mental gymnastics. The tip starts going down, 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 right? You start saying things like, we were paying to have a good time. What is this? This is ridiculous. Now, we've all been there. Let me just ask you, why do we have two different types of behavior for two different people? Why do we do this? Well, because one of them is your mom or your friend or your brother. And so we show them grace. We show kindness to our kind. But the other person is someone's mom. It's somebody's friend. It's somebody's brother. And it seems like what Jesus is challenging us to do is to say, hey, okay, if this is your moral circle, if these are the people that you would say they are included and everyone else is demonized, ostracized, put out of my circle, maybe Jesus is just saying to me and to you as well, would you just broaden your circle? Would you just stretch out your circle? Would you just make a decision to include people based on the fact that they've been given the image of God upon birth. That inside of them, that God has placed intrinsic value because of whose they are. Would you treat people based on that? See, I am finding in my life that the best way to approach relationships like this, because this is not easy for me. In fact, this is a real challenge. For my wife and I, where this is difficult is we live in a part of Atlanta where there was a predominantly American culture. And then all of a sudden, there's this convergence of different cultures from all around the world. And all of a sudden, people that have a predominantly American background are moving out of the neighborhood because they need a bigger basement. Awkward laughter, right? But see, that's not what's actually happening. And it's okay. It might be, we might need a move. It might be fine. I'm just saying, we've been trying to ask the question, hey, how would Jesus engage in a world like this? That's not a fun question to ask because sometimes it causes us to do things that are uncomfortable, that take courage, that's difficult, that takes effort. But I have found that if we can allow ourselves to be driven by curiosity, I think this is a powerful word, to find out, hey, what do I have to learn from this group of people? What do I have to learn from this person? Curiosity it's an exercise to learn something. It's letting somebody know, hey, I know I don't have everything going on in life. I would love to learn from you. You have something to offer me. Hey, this would be an example of this. February is Black History Month. You probably knew that. And maybe you've said before, well, why don't they have my certain history month? I would imagine that if you could become friends with or even engage with a black person and ask them, hey, why is Black History Month so important to you? You might learn something. And you might realize, oh, the other 11 months are white history months. And black people sometimes will be like, and most of February too. But you don't learn that until you engage with someone and have a conversation. And in the context of a relationship, ask some questions driven by curiosity. Have you noticed this? This is what's interesting to me about curiosity. Arrogant people don't ask questions. Why? Why don't arrogant people ask questions? Because they already know everything. They don't need to ask anything. They've already got it all figured out. Now, I'm not saying people that don't ask questions are arrogant. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying arrogant people don't ask questions. But curiosity is actually an exercise of humility. Curiosity is an exercise that we do to help ourselves become more humble. And when you approach relationships like Jesus did, leading with questions, trying to learn about someone, realizing this person has something to offer me, we can grow. Some of you are sitting here going, yeah, but when do we confront? When do we have the difficult conversation? Because you might really see the world you see, and you might think that somebody else in another group is wrong or is doing something to hurt other people. I have just found that the best time to confront, because sometimes you should confront. Sometimes you should have a hard conversation. Jesus did. Good grief. I mean, he asked this lady about the most delicate, important part of her life. He wasn't shy to confront, but he approached only with care and concern. If you approach only with, hey, I care for you, I love you, and I'm concerned for you, I think it would just go better for all of us. So let me ask you, if the church, if Christian people, if we started doing this, do you think it would help our faith? I think it would help our brand, you know, if you will. But I think it actually, I have found that it stretches my own faith, that it makes my faith bigger. Because I believe that your view of God will be as small as the size of your table. If you keep a small table, unfortunately, I think your view of God will always be that small. But I have learned in my own life, and you need to try this out for yourself. A lot of you are amazing at this. I have found that our view of God, that I think your view of God, that it grows as we make room for other people at our table. I don't think this makes our faith smaller. I think when you invite other people to sit down and say, hey, you're welcome at my table. You're welcome to sit here. I think it actually grows our faith. It makes our view of God bigger. And so I don't want you to miss out. And I know that I don't want to miss out on what God might be wanting to use someone else to teach me, to show me about what he's like and who he is. And I want God to use me to show people that I would never come in contact with what he's like, what he thinks, how he feels about them.